Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Hey, thanks for downloading the very latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. In a moment, we'll be talking with Peter Van Buren, the State Department whistleblower, and he reacts to the unusual letter signed by 51 colleagues or former colleagues of Van Buren's at the State Department urging direct attacks on the Assad government and its military assets in Syria. It's diplomats for more war. Peter Van Buren has some strong comments, and you'll hear him straight ahead. Before we get started, I always like to thank the people who support my work with your subscriptions to this podcast. People like Joey Perillo, Tim McKay, and Wendy Gebauer, and Abby McMillan. They're just four of the people who directly support this podcast, and I appreciate it very much. I invite you to join them. Come on over to peterbcollins.com, click on Menu, then click on Become a Subscriber, and it takes you to the sign-up page where you can take it from there. Thanks for listening, and thanks to all who support my work. Joining me today on the Peter B. Collins podcast, once again, State Department whistleblower Peter Van Buren. He spent a year in Iraq that led to his publication of a book called We Meant Well, and that led to his ultimate departure from the State Department while Hillary Clinton was running Foggy Bottom. Peter, thanks for returning to our podcast today.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Peter.
On Friday, June 17th, the New York Times reported on a dissent memo that some of your former colleagues at Foggy Bottom have signed. 51 individuals have signed it. And while apparently there is now a copy of it available, if you dig deeply enough on the New York Times website, so far I've really just seen pull quotes from it that have been used in the news accounts of this somewhat unusual communique. So the fundamentals appear to be that frustrated with the incoherent policies that they see enacted by the United States in Syria, they are calling for, and this is a little weird, these are diplomats who are calling for more war, more bloodshed, and they want to widen the war in Syria on the part of the United States to begin attacks on the Assad government and its military assets. And this seems like a real recipe for disaster that would create another failed state in the Middle East. And you wrote a pretty powerful post that I'm going to link to about this at your website, wementwell.com.
You know, Peter, this is a podcast, so you can't see me shaking my head in anger and disbelief. But that's what I'm doing. We basically have reached a point now where diplomats from the State Department are using a mechanism that is supposed to be to dissent from State Department policy in a proactive, courageous way to actually coddle up to John Kerry and the next president of the United States in calling for direct action, direct war directed at President Assad of Syria. And in the belief somehow that that will lead to a political slash peaceful resolution of the Syrian conflict. It is wrong in so many ways that it would really take us most of the day to go through them all. But in addition to those incoherent remarks by them, not me, you're left with the question of have they not seen a newspaper in the last 15 years? The United States has enacted regime change in Iraq with the catastrophic failures we've seen, including the essential creation of ISIS. Mm-hmm. We've done it in Libya, which turned a stable state into ungoverned territory. We've done it in Yemen, where, again, a relatively stable place has become ungoverned territory, where now we have a proxy war underway between our so-called allies, the Saudis, and the Iranians. And lots of other places historically in the Middle East, Iran in the 1950s, Egypt in various coups, etc., where we've done this regime change. And by the way, let's do away with that Orwellian term regime change and call it what it is, overthrowing a government.
Yeah.
It hasn't worked. It doesn't work. In an environment as complex as Syria, where you have so many actors vying for power, simply blowing away the one stable element, Assad, will create such a vacuum that it will draw in everyone into a fight that will make the current civil war look mild and actually create something quite apocalyptic for the territory we once knew as Syria.
Well, and it also creates this vacuum that really sharpens the focus in the region between Iran and Israel. And this seems to be the biggest blunder or unintended consequence, if we're to be generous, about the sentiments expressed in this dissent memo.
Absolutely. And the role of Israel has been largely left out of most of the mainstream media discussion simply because Israel is not overtly fighting in Syria. Actually, Israel has admitted that they do send some border excursions in when somebody gets a little too close to what they consider their territory in the Golan Heights. But generally speaking, Israel has limited itself to some sneaky Pete kind of work there. But there's no doubt that Israel will act to protect itself. And if Iranian proxies were to achieve too much authority in Syria, if Sunni organizations like ISIS were to achieve too much power in Syria, there's no question that Israel would act in its own self-defense. You then are talking about essentially a world war in the Middle East. You've got the Russians on the ground, you've got the Iranians and or their proxies on the ground, you've got the United States and whatever's left of its coalition on the ground, and you've got the Israelis standing in the wings, keeping a close eye on things. I mean, really, there's other than perhaps China, there's really not many people who have an interest in any of this who haven't yet stepped into the fight.
Mm-hmm. And so this seems to be just so counterintuitive that diplomats would look at this situation and say, we need to lob some cruise missiles into Damascus, and that'll fix it. I mean, it just seems so separate from reality, and yet these are the proposals of the current Secretary of State, and when Hillary Clinton had the job, she was aggressively lobbying for U.S. boots on the ground in Syria, and one of the emails that has been released from her State Department collection shows that she directly argued that the U.S. should intervene in Syria in 2012, not out of our interests, but in the interest of Israel.
Hillary's interests of Israel in the forefront are clearly a cornerstone of her campaign. I hasten to add, however, that Donald Trump is no stranger to calling for boots on the ground and more military action in the Middle East. And so as far as the United States getting tangled up further in Syria militarily, I don't know on that specific issue it matters which of them inherits the White House. But let's back up a few steps to the State Department diplomats calling for war. It's important to note that this so-called dissent did not originate in the CIA. It did not originate anywhere in the military. You know, the organizations that would have to carry out the State Department's bloody requests, and who would have to clean up the mess afterwards as they got stuck doing in Iraq and other places. What we see here very much is another example of the militarization of our foreign policy. Once upon a time, we had a very large toolbox that the United States used in interacting with countries overseas. Our goals were not pure. They were largely imperialistic or economic or what have you. But at least there were tools in that box that did not involve decimating civilian populations on a daily basis. There was this old-fashioned concept of diplomacy, which involved talking to people, making deals, if you will. There were economic tools. There were all these things. And military force was generally seen as the last resort. And that was good because it kills people, American people, foreign people, and it burns through a hell of a lot of money compared to diplomacy itself. we've now reached the point where foreign policy is fully militarized, because the State Department itself now, or at least a core group inside the State Department, are actually calling for military action directly against someone who is not fighting us. I think it's another important underline here is that Assad is not fighting the United States. The Syrians are not sponsoring terrorists. They're not sending people to the United States. They're not on Twitter trying to encourage so-called lone wolves or any of those things at all. Mm-hmm. In fact, the United States has had a bumpy but workable relationship with the Syrians since the 1970s. And certainly when the current Assad son Bashir took power about 10, 15 years ago. The first 5 years of his regime, the United States and he got along just fine. George W. Bush exported prisoners to Syria so they could be tortured by the Syrian security services. And Syria was a very nice player during the Iraq invasion and forgave any accidental incursions over his border. And we all got along fine until a couple of years ago when suddenly, in the Washington way, he transformed into another evil dictator.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was part of the axis of evil that Bush dreamed up, and he was, on the target list of the neocons' plan for a new American century.
Sure. But when we needed to work with him, we did. When we decided we didn't need to work with him, we instantly began the process of painting him as an evil dictator who attacks his own people. I mean, the script is not been rewritten in many years. The paper that they read off in the White House has got to be turning yellow at this point, where they just kind of scratch out Kim Jong-un and write in Bashar Assad or whoever the bully and bad guy of the day is.
Mm-hmm. So, Peter, one of the things that I will say is that while I don't agree with the intentions of this 51 member signers of this dissent memo, I welcome discussion about the war in Syria. We're coming up on 2 years since the president committed American air power. We know that covert operators were there before, and we now acknowledge that we have commandos on the ground. We pretend that they are trainers and consultants to these so-called moderate Syrian fighting units. But there has been no war powers authorization. There was a limited debate in March of this year when Congresswoman Barbara Lee led an effort to pass or at least get a war powers resolution going in the House of Representatives. And so the issues of the war and the wars in the Middle East have been largely ignored in the presidential campaign. There are really just a few exceptions to that: the Ted Cruz carpet bombing moments and a minor discussion between Clinton and Sanders in a couple of the debates. But these are really critical issues that are largely treated as whatever. And we're seeing that we're changing the plans for troop withdrawals from Afghanistan, and it draws yawns from the American public. And so Obama has really operated with very few political limitations. He's imposed many of his own, and I recognize that. But there has been no political cost. And Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard of Hawaii, who served in Iraq, she is really the lone voice in Washington today who is calling this madness for what it is. And so while, again, I don't agree with the expression itself, I welcome the idea that we're at least discussing these issues.
Sure. Discussion is fine, and no one can claim that it's a bad thing to talk about these issues. I think what the real issue is that we're not discussing the right things. I mean, certainly you just laid out a very quick list of things that are very much worthy of discussion, and none of that is really what we're talking about. I mean, essentially what this dissent memo has kicked off is another round of, well, should we be doing more fighting, more bombing? Should we be more aggressive in a situation where aggression has not proven very useful? We've gotten now, and it's interesting because it goes back to the vote for the Iraq war. Voting yes for that Iraq war is one of the factors that really hurt Hillary Clinton in her 2008 presidential bid, and it is not been a strong point for her in the primaries, though I suspect by now it's kind of washed its way through the media. So I think there's a lot of people in Congress who don't want to ask or answer those questions, either the way that the woman from Hawaii has done, which is largely through the media, or by, God forbid, doing something in Congress that requires people to take a vote. They're very happy to let the president go off in whatever direction he or later she might want to go. If it works, they'll help take credit. And, of course, if it doesn't work, their hands are clean when they run for reelection next time. And that works, again, that covers both ways. If it's ineffective, they can blame the president. If it's effective, they can nod clearly. But they don't have to put themselves on record one way or the other. And we've created this odd situation where the original constitutional intent that Congress is supposed to declare war, and Syria still is a sovereign state that we're attacking, which normally would require a declaration of war, and then the War Powers Act, the post-Vietnam, which was supposed to require Congress to renew these mini excursions into war, and we've now come to a point where everyone is looking the other way while the president makes war, figuring, hey, let him or her take the hit on this if necessary, because Congress really doesn't want to put its name to anything that's happening in the Middle East.
Well, and they keep shoveling more money. The House has proposed a military funding number that's like $20 billion higher than what the Senate and the White House have agreed on. And so they're willing to essentially fund on an unlimited basis these military adventures without taking a position on them. They will snipe at the president for being weak and for causing Orlando and, you know, all kinds of irrational things, but it is a very interesting approach that allows most of the members of Congress to just say, well, it's not my fault.
Exactly. And I think it's important to remember that the so-called legal justification for all of these wars going back 15 years is still based on some loose legislation that was passed in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. That has just been kind of recycled and reused and re-justified, countries that never were part of the post 9/11 landscape and issues that were never even considered. It's important to remember that ISIS, who's the bad, evil, whatever we're now currently fighting, didn't even exist when the justifications for the current war were actually voted on in Congress.
And neither did Al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula, and we used the post 9/11 blank check for the military adventures that we've been running in Yemen, although we've stepped back to allow the Saudis to own that carnage more recently.
Well, Peter, after we got chased out, yes.
Peter, one of the other considerations here is that the day before the letter from the 51 diplomats was it surfaced in the news, there was a dogfight in the skies right over the border of Syria and Iraq. There were Russian fighters that were deployed at the Al-Tanf crossing, and the U.S. took great exception to this because they were dropping bombs on the so-called moderate Syrian democratic forces that the U.S. Is not so covertly supporting. And so we scrambled jets, who then pushed the Russians out of this airspace. When our jets had to leave to be refueled, the Russians came back and attacked our proxy forces there. And this is the kind of recipe that the diplomats in the State Department either ignored or are oblivious to, because with Russia having entered in the past year the battles in Syria, it really does obviate the Hillary Clinton proposed no-fly zone and any unilateral military action by the United States against the Assad government.
We have to understand that the United States and Russia are engaged in one of the proxy wars that are going on in Syria right now by supporting different sides, and that has metastasized now into essentially overt war between the United States and Syria. It is only a matter of time before one side, quote, accidentally, unquote, shoots down something from the other side. Now, we're not going to start World War III that afternoon, of course. Nobody wants that, either the Russians nor us. But it's just not a step in the right direction when something happens that involves the two superpowers actually blowing one another away in some concept. And it's going to happen. It can't not happen given how tight the airspace is there, and how powerful the weapons are that are being used, and how much, what would be the right word, sort of hot-dogging that must be going on. This was a big part of the Cold War. You know, one side would fly a little too close to the border of the other side, and radars would be turned on, and missiles would be activated in a way that everyone could see electronically that was happening, and signals were sent back and forth. You know, once you start to get into that, people get hurt. Accidents do happen. And none of that, by the way, has much to do with what's going on with Syria, has much to do with supporting or defeating ISIS or any of these other things. We're right back to the silly games that troubled us all through the 60s, 70s, and early 80s.
Peter, in a commentary that you posted at your website, wementwell.com, you wrote, "The dissent memo makes no suggestions, actually no mention at all, about who would succeed Assad, or how this regime change would be any different than the failed attempts in Iraq, Libya, or Yemen, or how ISIS, who also seeks the end of the Assad regime through violence, would not be further empowered, or how the U.S. would get away with airstrikes given the overt Russian support that we just mentioned here a second ago." So you capture in one paragraph a lot of the so-called day-after issues that the U.S. neglected to deal with in previous regime changes. And yet we don't seem to have learned any lessons. And for these 51 diplomats to take this route is really kind of scary.
It absolutely is. You know, Americans have been accused of not understanding or remembering or studying history, and there's certainly too much truth in that. But these are, first of all, diplomats who supposedly are better schooled in these things than the average person. And they're people who really should know better, because somewhere in their career, they or their colleagues or the people they eat lunch with or work with have already dealt with what happens when you overthrow a government. And by the way, I'm slowly transitioning from using the term regime change to what it really is, which is overthrowing a government. Mm-hmm. You know, they must have seen somebody in the hallway who mumbled something about Afghanistan or Iraq or Libya or Yemen and things. But at the same time, and I think this is unfortunately something worth focusing on, is the New York Times has characterized the signers of this memo as mid-level officers at the State Department. The names have all been redacted, because why should anyone taking a courageous stand have to actually put his or her name in the public eye, right?
Yeah.
Even though they leaked the memo themselves. But anyway, never mind that. That's what courage is worth these days. But the idea would be that if, as a mid-level officer, you're probably looking at most of these people have less than 10 years experience in the State Department. The average entry levels plus 10 years suggests that many of these folks were teenagers or young adults on 9/11.
Hmm.
Their knowledge of these events is largely secondhand at this point. They've read about them. They probably didn't get around to studying them in any kind of depth, because by the time they were in college, there really isn't much material to work with the way colleges, you know, like textbooks and scholarly things. And so their understanding of what's happened is secondhand. They might as well be reading about or thinking about World War II and, you know, talking about the tactics we used against the Japanese and the Nazis and how those may apply. Ignorance is not bliss. More people would be happy if that was true. But in this case, ignorance is a very, very deadly thing for the Syrians and, of course, for the Americans who are going to have to carry out these bloodthirsty plots.
Peter, one of the reasons I refer to Obama's strategy towards Syria and the whole mess there as incoherent is that if you simply make a comparison to Egypt, just a few borders away, where in the Arab Spring, democracy broke out, they elected a Muslim, Mohamed Morsi, and a year into it, the U.S. supported the military coup that we still can't quite call a coup, and we've allowed a military dictatorship to resurface in Cairo. We're very comfortable. We still keep shipping them arms. There have been very limited efforts to affect the behavior of the al-Sisi government. And so when, you know, Assad sits in Damascus and says, why me? Here is a military dictator who brutally suppresses his people. More journalists have just been sentenced to death in Egypt. And not a peep out of the United States, yet, you know, we are hell-bent on taking out Bashar al-Assad.
Well, there's a couple of differences. The first one is that Assad's army still appears quite loyal to him. It's been 5 years of conflict across Syria, including extraordinary pressure from the United States and other foreign powers, a pretty strong ISIS attack, and his army has stuck by him. So the idea that the United States could engineer a coup, as it did in Egypt, doesn't seem to apply over there. More importantly, the plan in Egypt was good old-fashioned America, you know, American government overthrow stuff, where we went back to our roots and actually had someone in the wings standing by to step in once the government we didn't like was overthrown. This is the model that we followed in Iran in the 1950s, in Vietnam, all through Central America, where we had our guy take over from the guy we didn't like. The problem with Assad is we didn't really have a guy, and the army wasn't willing to rise up against him, and still isn't. And by the time somebody got around to paying attention, there were all these foreign forces, all these proxy fighters, all these various elements on the playing field, and that precluded much manipulation the way that a place like Egypt sort of cried out for the CIA to step in and set things in motion. So sorry, Assad, your troops were too loyal to you. Otherwise, you'd either, you know, he'd either be hanging from a lamppost or quietly enjoying his villa wherever the United States settled him, maybe Pakistan.
Peter, I want to shift to a couple of other topics here. Is there anything else you'd like to add about the dissent memo from the 51 State Department individuals?
The final thing is just a little bit of inside baseball about dissent in the State Department. There is an established mechanism to dissent, and it's called the dissent channel. And it goes back to the old days when telegrams were the way communications were done, and there were different channels that for different purposes. There was one for personnel issues and one for political issues and so forth. The dissent channel was created during the Vietnam War basically to give a very disgruntled foreign service a way of expressing their thoughts on what was going on in the war, kind of under the table, if you will, of getting information back to Washington that was not fitting with what the administration wanted to hear. Over the years, a number of people have risked their careers to use the dissent channel to say things are not going well out here, guys, and you better pay attention to what's really happening. Almost all of those dissents were kept quiet, as they were intended to be. A lot of, for example, in Central America during the 1980s, a lot of dissent messages flowed back to Washington. The idea of using the dissent channel to basically try to tell the next president of the United States what he or she should do, which is what this is all about, as well as using the dissent channel so openly to leak something into the media, really is quite a bad thing to say about an institution that once actually patted itself on the back for having a way to allow its lower-level people to speak truth to power.
Mm-hmm. So, Peter, I want to ask, because there have been some military gains against the Islamic State, and notably, the Baghdad government is claiming that they have taken control of Fallujah once again after a two-plus-year occupation by the Islamic State. Now, the reports vary from controlling 90% of Fallujah to, on the high end, to as low as 25%. That was a quote from the PBS NewsHour in the last day or two. So if we accept this spin that Baghdad has recaptured Fallujah, as you mentioned in a post about this, it's pretty well destroyed. And we have tens of thousands of refugees who are Sunnis, primarily, who are not being permitted to take refuge in the Shiite-controlled areas to the east in Baghdad. And so there is the risk here of further carnage as the refugees are left either out in the desert in the blistering summer heat or marched into some sort of camps where, you know, they certainly could be picked off by Shiites in a kind of score-settling manner. And so I'd like to get your thoughts about what happens next, because while there does appear to be a military gain, the losses are immense, and the struggle is not over, particularly for control of Iraq.
What we're seeing here in these declarations of victory, or that such a city is liberated, or ISIS has been defeated, is essentially a very cynical scorched earth policy. The Fallujah, whatever part, is controlled by so-called Iraqi forces, which are basically Shia militias at this point, has been destroyed. I mean, it is clearly a case of if we just blow everything up, well, there's nothing left for ISIS to hold. And if there are any people left fighting there, we'll simply shell the entire block until we get that one guy. If you want to know what's going on inside Fallujah right now, where reporters are hard-pressed to get into, you simply have to look at Ramadi, which was liberated about 6 months ago. Right now, we're talking about something like 85% of the city has been destroyed. Almost no money has flowed there to rebuild anything. You've got a refugee crisis, a humanitarian crisis. You had a siege laid to an intensely populated urban area that would make the Nazis blush at Stalingrad. The same thing is happening now in Fallujah, and we'll soon start seeing pictures, I suspect, showing us what's actually going on. The fact that the people doing the killing are Shias, militias, and the people who are being killed or being turned into refugees or left to essentially die in the desert are Sunnis, will only set the stage for more sectarian conflict. The reason the Sunnis have supported ISIS is because they needed protection against the Shia majority. Mm-hmm. People are paying attention to what's happening. Everyone's watching, and we're simply laying the groundwork for Iraq War 4.
And in a similar vein, Professor Juan Cole at the University of Michigan posted on June 19th, as Iraq rolls back Daesh, can it stay together as a country? And this is the question that, you know, has been before us now for a number of years. And it really does appear that the de facto partitioning of Iraq has occurred. And, you know, even if you vanquish the Islamic State from Anbar province, where Fallujah is, you know, what comes next? And this is that same vacuum that on a smaller scale we've been talking about in Syria.
Well, that's an interesting point. I think what we should do is send all of the 51 diplomats who are calling for some form of attack on Assad and regime change there, I think we should all send them on a little excursion out to Anbar province and let them get a good look at what happens when you do that. Basically, Iraq, as anyone knew it prior to 2003 as a nation state, is no longer there. The Kurds have carved themselves out a northern enclave, confederacy, if you will, and the only question there is how long they'll be fighting in Turkey and Syria to enhance their own borders. The Shias have seized near complete control with Iranian help of the central government and are engaged in a process that they would probably want to be called ethnic cleansing. I suspect that the United States will still exert enough influence that the Sunnis in Anbar and western Iraq will probably be pushed into some form of an enclave, statelet at best, and the United States will probably keep the Shias from annihilating them completely, though there'll be an awful lot of dead people in between now and then, and the risk of the United States, of course, losing interest in all this and wandering off in search of some other shiny object is quite great.
And finally, Peter, I'd just like to get a brief comment from you on the status of the Hillary Clinton State Department email scandal. In my view, there are very substantive issues here, and the content of the emails is as troubling as the procedural matters of, you know, her keeping her own server that was susceptible to hacking, that was not properly secure. And we know, as you have pointed out in some of your commentary, that, for example, CIA officers were named in these emails that were sent unsecurely to Hillary Clinton. And John Kiriakou wound up taking the plea bargain over unintentional disclosure of a CIA officer's name that was never even published. So by that standard, Hillary Clinton appears to be culpable. Yet it seems that the Obama Justice Department is going to keep spinning wheels, but not actually close this case anytime soon.
You know, I take my hat off to the evil geniuses inside the Clinton campaign who have managed to find ways to spin everything that's come out, all the facts that you just mentioned that are pretty black and white, and have created an environment where the majority of voters know that those facts are true, but don't care anyway. That's an impressive piece of political work that I think will be studied for very many, many, many years. At this point in time, the only thing I can see derailing this, the Clinton campaign over this issue, would be some type of leak. Someone brave enough inside the FBI or the Department of Justice or perhaps CIA who realizes that this is a form of an American coup, that it is a complete travesty of justice that this information won't come out in the form of an indictment, and decides to take it upon him or herself, the way Snowden did, the way Manning did, and get some of this information out there to the point where it cannot be ignored. That's the Snowden thing. Mm-hmm. People like Tom Drake and others who you've interviewed, I know, were talking about the NSA for years and years and years, but they didn't have the documents in hand. What Snowden put out there was undeniable. You couldn't pretend it wasn't true. And that is what it's going to take here. Whether there is someone brave enough inside the law enforcement community to put those emails, to put those facts on WikiLeaks or someplace else, remains to be seen. But I think that is the only possible way that she will not get away with all of this.
Peter Van Buren, always a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for joining me today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this in-depth interview with State Department whistleblower Peter Van Buren. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.